From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Mexico's ongoing drug war has taken 28,000 lives since Mexican President Felipe Calderon began a militarized campaign against the cartels in 2006. Among the casualties are at least 30 journalists killed or disappeared. Last Sunday, after the murder of staff photographer Luis Carlos Santiago, the newspaper El Diario of Ciudad Juarez printed an editorial on its front page titled, "What Do You Want From Us?" A query both angry and plaintive, directed at the cartels. On Wednesday, Calderon announced a plan to help protect journalists, but that's likely to be of limited solace because there's no trustworthy authority in Juarez. Gerardo Rodriguez is an editor for El Diario. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, can you tell me exactly what your editorial said?
It's asking the leaders of the plaza, and this is the territories that are run by violent cartels, that in this war between them and the government, we are in the middle, under fire, and we're not getting a clear message why are they killing our journalists. Armando Rodriguez was a police reporter who got killed less than 2 years ago in front of his house, killed in front of his daughter. His crime has not been solved, even though we had promises from the presidency. And then Luis, last week.
The photographer.
Yes. He was shot in the middle of the day in a mall. And then the killer ran and chased his companion, which is also a graphic reporter for our newspaper. Both were wearing their IDs for the newspaper. The other photographer is alive, but he's in a secret location.
Is it true that in Juarez, only about 2% of these drug-related murders are actually solved?
Yes, it is. Only 3% get ever to courts, and less than those are solved.
So the paper's editorial read, quote, "It is impossible for us to do our job under these conditions. Tell us, then, what do you expect from us as a newspaper?" You didn't really expect the cartels to respond with a bill of particulars, did you?
Well, of course, we are not expecting a direct message. This is reading in an ironic manner. It used to be that they would call the TV stations and the newsrooms and they would threaten. But now, without any notice or without us knowing why, they're killing our reporters. And we just don't think a story is worth life.
You say that there was a certain ironic intent in your editorial, but it reads like a real cry of the heart. What was your actual intention?
To send a message, you know, that we recognize that they are the authority in town because the authorities are non-existent. The cartels are not just criminal, you know, sometimes they're politicians. We're recognizing this fact, which everybody talks about in Mexico, but it's not published very often.
So who do you think the principal target for El Diario's message was? Was it the cartels, the Mexican authorities, the American authorities?
They just gave asylum for the first time to a Mexican reporter here in the United States. And he's from Juarez. So it seems that the United States authorities are recognizing this now. We've been waiting for that for a long time.
You said that you hope that this story will get a lot of play in the American media. What do you think they can do to help?
Well, not just in American media. We receive calls from everywhere, London, Canada, Latin America, from people who tell us that we're very courageous to publish the feeling of the people of Juarez. We're very angry, very sad. We don't know who to go to. We're just frustrated. Also, let me tell you, yesterday, a lot of people just got fed up with the authorities that they're not doing anything. So they killed two criminals with their own hands, you know, just caught them and in vigilante style, they just took their law into their own hands.
What would be the ideal response to your editorial?
Well, I hope that people understand that this war is being fought over our city, a place where a lot of things go from south to north and from north to south. And that's not going to stop. The use of drugs are increasing in the United States. We're all responsible for what's going on in Juarez. the criminal cartels are worldwide, and there's not a unilateral solution to this. It's not a Mexican problem. It's an international problem.
Do you see a future for reporters in Mexico reporting on the drug trade? Or do you think that there's simply nowhere to go from here?
Our reporters are very courageous. They're using bulletproof vests now, and we just bought life insurance for some of the reporters. And they're very courageous. The people in Mexico are very courageous. Mexican society is getting fed up with this violence. And even though right now I'm hopeless, I think that things are changing.
Gerardo, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Gerardo Rodriguez is an editor for El Diario in Ciudad Juarez.
In the early 2000s, Iranian expat Hossein Darakhshan, from his adopted home of Canada, helped inspire a network of dissident bloggers throughout the Iranian diaspora. An influential critic of both the Iranian government and its supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, he was dubbed the blog father of Iran. Years later, Darakhshan, his sympathies changed, grew far less critical. And in 2008, he returned to Iran, where he was promptly imprisoned and is now on trial, facing a slew of charges, including, according to reports by the BBC, quote, collaborating with enemy states, creating propaganda against the Islamic regime, and insulting religious sanctity. News came this week that prosecutors in Iran are seeking Darakhshan's execution. Newsweek correspondent Maziar Bahari found himself in a similar situation last year when he was imprisoned and tortured in Iran for 4 months, and then, after a media campaign waged by his employer and his family, was suddenly released. Bahari told us that Darakhshan might not be so lucky.
Hossein Darakhshan is a clear case of an internal battle between the Revolutionary Guards and the Ministry of Intelligence. Allegedly, he was promised by Ministry of Intelligence that he could go back to Iran without any problem. But the Revolutionary Guards, they were the people who arrested me. And they also arrested Hossein in order to teach the Ministry of Intelligence a lesson that they can do whatever they want to do.
And fundamentally, the Iranians don't recognize dual citizenship. So the fact that Darakhshan has an Iranian passport, as far as they're concerned, renders his Canadian-ness irrelevant.
That's what the Iranian government and the Revolutionary Guard say. In my case, and in case of many other dual citizens, including Roxana Sabri, if the second country of that person, in my case Canada, in Roxana's case the United States, if they're vocal about their citizens, then the Iranian government listens and reacts to the actions of the foreign government. Iran really wants to be a legitimate government internationally. I think that Hossein Darakhshan's family should have been vocal from the beginning, because only people who have had a campaign for them have been released.
Darakhshan now faces a death sentence for doing nothing more than communicating with dissidents. That doesn't sound like the activity of a government that craves legitimacy.
They want to teach a big lesson to all the people who are thinking about cyber activities in Iran that, you know, we are dealing with you like a criminal. Hossein, the only thing he did was criticize the Iranian government in the past. Before his arrest, for 2-3 years, he was very complimentary about Ahmadinejad. And he actually said that Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the founder of the revolution, was one of the greatest men in history.
So he's kind of an unlikely target for the anger of the regime.
Well, the problem with this regime is that we don't know what is likely and what is unlikely. It's sometimes cynically pragmatic, sometimes it's ideological, and sometimes totally irrational. The Iranian government thinks that its survival is in creating an insecure atmosphere for the people inside Iran and also make itself unpredictable in the international scene.
We don't know who the prime actors are and what their motives are, but if it is to intimidate the diaspora and Iranians living in Iran from in any way connecting with the dissident community, isn't this apt to have exactly the opposite effect?
You're right. The Iranian government acts like a desperate person and just considers its short-term interest. But it can have really negative consequences for Iran and also for the regime that is running Iran right now.
You said approximately the same thing in an op-ed in the New York Times, an open letter to the Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, imploring him to free journalists.
Yeah.
Who was the audience for that? I'm going to assume that the Ayatollah doesn't, you know, spend his mornings over coffee flipping through the New York Times.
Well, that article was translated into Persian, and it was on all the Persian websites. I'm not sure whether Ayatollah read it or not, but, you know, I don't have his personal address, so I couldn't send it to him. But my point in that open letter to Khamenei was that if you allow criticism, it's not only good for the country, it's good for you. It guarantees your own survival.
You have been in Darakshan's place. What is he likely experiencing right now in prison?
My interrogator used to tell me that one morning I wake you up, I put you on a chair, I put the noose around your neck and just kick the chair off your feet. And I'm sure that Hussein is going through the same thing. A lot of psychological as well as physical pressure. Basically, they're going to make his life hell for him.
Will they execute him?
I don't think so. I think they're going to change their decision and maybe they give a 15-year or 25-year sentence, which is still a very harsh sentence for someone who blocked, someone who did not use violence, someone who did not do anything illegally.
Mazyar, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Mazyar Bahari is an Iranian-Canadian reporter for Newsweek. He was jailed and tortured in Iran from June to October of 2009. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 2005, in the online world called Legend of Mir 3, Chu Chunwei acquired a dragon saber after long hours of play. It was one of the most potent weapons in this virtual world, with a market price in China of almost $1,000. His friend's avatar asked to borrow the sword, but instead of returning it, Chu's friend sold it and pocketed the cash. Chu first turned to the Chinese police, but it didn't regard the dragon saber as legal property and sent Chu away. So Chu went to his friend's real home and killed him with a real knife before turning himself in. Could the tragedy have been averted if the authorities had simply regarded the dragon saber as real property? Thus, the murky legal sphere known as virtual law. Greg Listoka is a professor of law at Rutgers University and author of Virtual Justice, the New Laws of Online Worlds. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Do you have any idea how much merchandise is exchanged in these virtual worlds? I mean, what kind of a business it is?
The size of virtual economies, virtual property economies, is around $2 billion a year.
These are virtual worlds like Second Life and World of Warcraft. But even programs like Farmville on Facebook traffic in virtual property sometimes, right?
That's right. Farmville is an application that runs on top of Facebook. And in Farmville, you have an avatar and a little plot of land. What Farmville lets you do is send your friends messages and say, please help me on my farm. And you can help them out by giving them nails or horseshoes for their barns. And you might not have to pay a lot of money. You might pay $5, $10, $25. But if you have enough people doing it, you can make a lot of money that way. So there are about 70 million people, I think, who play Farmville. And if 10% of them are paying, you know, $25 for some gas for their virtual tractor, it adds up.
Isn't virtual property owned by the company who owns the game?
There was a case about this recently, Bragg versus Linden Lab, where a lawyer bought thousands of dollars of virtual land in the virtual world of Second Life. And at a certain point, the game owners decided that he'd done something that they didn't consider fair play. So they canceled his account and confiscated all of his virtual land. And he brought a lawsuit saying that they had unlawfully taken his property. The company didn't really address the issue of property confiscation, but it said, before you actually started using Second Life, you agreed to our terms of service.
And of course, we all read those with incredible care.
The court found that the terms of service were an unconscionable contract that it would not enforce.
Linden Labs, which runs Second Life, encourages people to open up businesses and to accumulate property, but then says in its terms of service, no matter how much money you spend, you don't really own this stuff. And if you do something that irritates us, we can take it all away from you. This is what the court said was not enforceable. On the other hand, since it's settled out of court, there's no precedent.
That's exactly right. These terms of service for these online worlds are not completely bulletproof. But by and large, I think most legal commentators who look at this say that the companies do get to set their own rules.
And in some worlds, theft is okay. In some worlds, murder is okay. Should their laws be determined by the consent of those who are governed in them?
The way that the law is structured today, we are really kind of carving out separate jurisdictions online and setting up these virtual world owners as the governments of this sphere. It could be that real governments will be more involved in virtual worlds if things start going awry. In the Republic of Korea, for instance, they have a lot of broadband usage and a kind of deep history of online games. So their government has been very much on top of the issues of virtual property. And there have been thousands of prosecutions for virtual property fraud and theft in South Korea.
Could you, if you were playing World of Warcraft in, say, Staten Island, New York, sue in Korea?
This is something that the game companies are worried about. So World of Warcraft is owned by Blizzard Activision. It has a very sophisticated team of lawyers, and they sometimes tailor the software so that in different jurisdictions you have different rules and different contracts.
Does this mean we're really going to have to read those terms of service?
Well, if you do read them, you might not be able to understand them. So I don't know if that's exactly the answer. But I think when you see, for instance, what Facebook has done with its terms of service and the outcry over the way that it's redrafted those from time to time in terms of user privacy, you could see a similar thing, I think, happening with virtual worlds. So there's this struggle between the demands of the marketplace and the concerns and needs of the users.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Greg Listoka is a professor of law at Rutgers University.
On Monday, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee proposed legislation to combat digital piracy. The new law would give the Justice Department new tools to shut down websites dedicated to illegal content sharing. The measure enjoys rare bipartisan support, and one of the bill's sponsors, Vermont's Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy, claimed that it will protect American investment and jobs. Greg Sandoval is a senior writer for CNET. Hey, Greg, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
First, tell me about this new law called the Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeits Act. That's coy. How would it work?
It sounds like the Attorney General is going to have lots and lots of leeway to go to a judge and say, hey, these guys are trafficking in unauthorized films, TV shows, music, and we want them shut down. But they haven't given us a criteria of how they're going to decide a website is a pirate site. And a judge either has to be really informed, really skeptical to challenge these guys.
The sites in the sites of the Senate Judiciary Committee quintessentially are like a pirate bay, which it seems to exist only to facilitate illegal downloading of protected intellectual property.
Pirate Bay really is the poster child for this kind of law. It was founded by three Scandinavians, and the U.S. trade representative has tried for years to get them shut down. The site is operated in multiple countries. They've made no bones about wanting to help people get a hold of free movies, music, books. I would say that this law should really be called the Pirate Bay Law or the Anti-Pirate Bay Law.
And because they're offshore, the U.S. government has been limited. What in the proposed law would give the Justice Department the tools to shut down something like Pirate Bay?
They're going to go to a judge and say, we need an order for internet service providers like AT&T, Comcast, and tell them they're going to have to block access to this. They'll go to Visa or MasterCard and say, you guys can't do any transactions for any of these sites. And they can go to Google and say, you cannot pay them any more advertising revenue if they've got Google AdSense on their site. If it passes, they're going to be able to essentially black out these sites and then stop them from generating income from the United States.
Now, the Motion Picture Association of America and the recording industry have long been advocating for strict anti-piracy legislation just like this. But they've been stymied in the past. What's changed?
I would say what's changed is that the president and Vice President Biden have received a lot of backing from the entertainment sector. And last summer, Vice President Biden said, piracy is smash and grab theft. There's going to be plenty of people who are going to say, in these hard economic times, we shouldn't be in the business of protecting films and music. These companies already have a ability to file civil suits, to go to the ISPs and try to do this through the courts. President Obama, Vice President Biden continue to say, though, that the U.S. government has to have an active hand in protecting jobs. And here's the side of the content owners. They say they're getting killed by piracy. They say they're losing jobs. They can't survive without some help from the government. The stats that Hollywood has provided in the music industry have been discredited by the government itself, a GAO report. However, the GAO said there's plenty of anecdotal evidence that shows Hollywood and the music industry are suffering as a result of piracy.
The other big question is constitutionality. The bill seems to tread kind of heavily on freedom of speech, saying if your website is dedicated to aiding and abetting pirates, we shut you down. Will we next have the Justice Department shutting down jihadist websites and marijuana legalization sites? You get the point. It's the slippery slope question.
And that's going to be one of the many challenges this bill is going to face. I'm sure Senator Leahy understands that. I don't see this bill getting through without at least a very tough fight.
Even if PirateBay.org and other well-known pirating sites are shuttered, won't the digital pirates just find it some other less visible sites or some other means entirely to facilitate illegal file sharing?
This bill, even if it passes, will not be checkmate. Last year, I went to Hollywood and I talked to a lot of studio people, and they were depressed because there's this new system of sharing files. You're not even downloading anything. You're getting streaming video from underground sites. And one member of the film industry told me that with some of these streaming sites, they don't even know what country they're in, where their servers are. One of the most famous guys, allegedly, is a German who is very brash. And he's out there offering free streaming. You don't have to download any software. You get a link to his site, all the Mad Men episodes, all the movies, and it's easy to do, and it's going to hit mainstream America, and that's what Hollywood is worried about right now.
Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Sandoval is a senior writer for CNET.
The internet has instigated a raging debate about piracy and intellectual property. It's never been so easy to access, copy, and distribute so much work created by somebody else. And yet, according to Lewis Hyde, Kenyon College professor and a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center, the issues underlying intellectual property aren't new. They were of utmost concern to America's founding fathers. In particular, says Hyde, the founders brought three ideas to bear on the issue of copyright. The first was in regards to democratic participation. They had seen the way the British monarchy controlled the flow of information by giving publishing monopolies to favored printers. Uninformed people were less likely to participate. But Jefferson, Adams, Madison, and Franklin were building a new republic in which the citizenry needed to participate. And so they took pains to lower the barriers to information.
So John Adams's very first political essay was an attack on the Stamp Act. Now, when I was a kid, they taught me the Stamp Act was bad because it was taxation without representation. But Adams never talks about that. What he talks about is this was a tax on paper, and paper was how ideas were carried, and therefore it was a tax on ideas, and therefore it was like the old monopolies that the church and the state in Europe had used to keep the population in what he called a state of sordid ignorance and staring timidity.
Now, I'm right in saying that there were three views that prevailed at the time, right? There was the one that talks about democratic governance, which you just described, and a second one that was focused more on the need to foster a creative community. And for this, Ben Franklin was the guy.
Yes, Franklin was a wonderful inventor, but also a scientist who was a member of an international scientific community. And he felt and understood that scientific community works best if the barriers to expression are very low. So Franklin himself never took a patent, never copyrighted his work. And in fact, when was approached by people who did what we would now call acts of piracy, he tended to support them if, in fact, it was to the benefit of the public.
Tell me about the third view of copyright. Who championed it? It involved the ability of the public to be public actors.
Well, in a sense, all of these people did. The very first Copyright Act in this country gave owners 14 years that they could renew once. That's 28 years. The puzzle here is where to place the limit. One way I come at this is to talk about what used to be called civic republicanism. And it begins with the assumption that the point of property is not simply to enrich individuals, but to give them a base from which they can then begin to turn their attention to their community. So there's two steps to this. I call it the Republican two-step. On the one hand, you have individual autonomy, but then the question is, why are you autonomous? Why are you free? And the answer to that for the 18th century was, you are free to try to serve your community. And I think that the early copyright law had this built into it. It gave a short-term private privilege in exchange for a long-term public benefit.
What about the argument that people have the right to make a living off of their creative work?
People absolutely have this right, and nothing in my book is opposed to that. The question always is, what are the larger public ends by which we have shaped these rules? The founding generation was very wary of what's called perpetuities, situations in which property was owned forever, because perpetuities were one of the ways that the aristocracy in Europe controlled their power for centuries. This is one reason that they put a limit on the term of copyright. And what we've done now is to extend the term of copyright such that it is statistically almost perpetual. The founders would be astounded.
You cite three modern illustrations of how these ideas played out: the Human Genome Project, Bob Dylan, and the work of Martin Luther King.
So what you can do is to take the founders' ideas and use them to think about the modern situation. So a positive case would be the way the publicly funded human genome research was done. This was done internationally, funded both from the public purse in this country and from private philanthropies in England and so forth. And the whole way it was done was to share data in a collective enterprise. And this would have made perfect sense to somebody like Benjamin Franklin. And similarly, I look at a creative artist like Bob Dylan in the early 60s, who was a cultural sponge. Not that he doesn't have individual genius, but the individual genius is mixed with the collectivity that you can only have if the culture around you is freely available.
And Martin Luther King?
Well, the King case is a sort of sorry reversal of this, because his estate has regularly stood in the way of scholars and others using King's work in the way that King himself clearly would have wanted it used. Simple example is, USA Today published his I Have a Dream speech on Martin Luther King Day one year, and the estate went after for copyright infringement. I mean, this is crazy. You know, this is a person who wanted and was a spiritual and political public actor, and whose work came out of a great collective of African-American action over the past century.
Then there's another example, the civil rights anthem, We Shall Overcome.
Nobody quite knows where the song came from, but it begins to be used in picket lines in the 1940s, and then it gets picked up by people in the civil rights movement, and then people like Pete Seeger and his friends sing it, and they change it. And then there comes a moment when they realize that if they don't protect it in some way, it may be abused. And so they actually take out a copyright. But what they do is to set up a public trusteeship and give the income from the royalties on that song to the civil rights movement in the South. It's an example of what I call claim and release. That is to say, using the law to say, okay, I own this thing, but now that I have claimed it, I'm also going to let other people use it. And what happened in the last 30 or 40 years is others have adopted this model. So in the software community, they have a thing called the general public license, in which somebody writes a piece of software and then gives it to the world under a license that lets anybody use it, so long as they continue to treat it as a common property. It's a nice middle ground between pure private ownership and an unowned commons.
Lewis, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure to talk with you.
Lewis Hyde is a faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Center and author of Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership.
Coming up, gossip, yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. The Kauffman Foundation, educating entrepreneurs about how to start and grow businesses through Kauffman Fast Track at fasttrack.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. My interview last week with editor and publisher of the Portland Press Herald drew a strong response. We called him about an apology he had written to readers who'd objected to the September 11th front page coverage of the end of Ramadan. The editor agreed with the critics. He wrote that the Ramadan reporting should have been balanced by coverage of the anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Roughly half of those who wrote to OTM objected to my tone in what admittedly became a testy exchange. For instance, Greg Maupai of Green Pond, New Jersey wrote, quote, "I found your reporter's interview of Richard Connor to be offensive. It was argumentative and akin to the journalistic rabble-rousing so prevalent on the cable TV talking head shows I try to avoid by listening to quality radio shows instead." Rolf Linder of Lexington, Kentucky felt likewise. Quote, "Bob Garfield was off base in the interview. He had an agenda, and it showed. It would have been more interesting if he had engaged his guest in a dialogue about how to balance real news reporting with public opinion."
But Edie Doty of Portland, Maine, was one of many to jump to Bob's defense. She wrote, quote, "I am a subscriber to the Portland Press Herald, and I was appalled by Richard Connor's apology. On the Media has taken nothing out of context. The questioning of Richard Connor is fair, and the reason the interviewer questions him harder is because Connor is denying what he quite plainly wrote. His apology does indeed state that the coverage of Ramadan should have been balanced with the coverage of 9/11. She added, "For background, 10 years ago, there were only a handful of Muslims in Maine. Portland has since resettled many Somali refugees, so a Ramadan ceremony of the size covered in the newspaper is indeed news. Connor, who is relatively new to Maine himself, had a golden opportunity to address the anti-Muslim hysteria sweeping the country and to appeal to people's better selves. He blew it."
Thanks to all who wrote in. Please keep your comments coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org or post to our website at onthemedia.org. And please tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. In a July 1940 profile of Walter Winchell, New Yorker editor St. Clair McGelway called gossip writing a bacterium in the body of journalism.
"New York, the famous woman explorer and hunter, Oza Johnson, has started annulment proceedings against her second husband, a lecture agent named Clark Getz. The charges, I am told, will be sensational."
Walter Winchell ruled the world of gossip in the mid-20th century, but we can trace New York City's modern reign over gossip journalism to the late 1970s, when the New York Post introduced its Page Six column. "Now New York's star is fading," writes Foster Kamer in the Village Voice, "but it was the Post's Page Six that made gossip mongering the team sport it remains today."
Whereas before it was just information running through one person, now it was a team who had various stringers going out, getting stories, bringing them back to the headquarters, and putting them together in a calm that came down like thunder from Mount Olympus every day.
So successful was Page Six that the New York Daily News, the competing tabloid, felt obliged to bring in a series of gossip heavy hitters to try to compete.
Well, Page Six was pretty much unchallenged until George Rush and Joanna Molloy came along 15 years ago. They were a wife and husband duo. Then 7 years ago, Lloyd Grove, a Washington Post reporter, came to the Daily News for what he called a lot of green. And Lloyd Grove was vicious. He was a political reporter who was used to getting scooped and having to scoop other people, and Page Six wasn't used to being scooped. So really, every day was a competition for these two heavyweights.
What was the beginning of the end for the primacy of the New York tabloids?
I would say it was really when Gawker showed up, nobody saw it coming. Richard Johnson, the editor of Page Six, told the New York Observer at one point, because we have a brand, we're never going to be challenged. Meanwhile, Gawker was online. Gawker never dealt with lawyers, which Page Six and the Daily News has go over their columns every single day. Gawker was essentially going to push the edge until they were told not to by a legal authority. They were operating 24 hours a day. They could print whenever they wanted.
And because they were online, had a vastly larger pool of sources and a vastly larger potential audience.
Exactly. They were reaching people that weren't really necessarily interested in gossip before, and they were also writing about people who had never been written about before, including the gossips.
A much lower threshold of celebrity than the tabloids ever demanded.
I think Gawker was finding compelling characters and compelling narratives in places that people had never found them before. One perfect example is Cy Newhouse, the chairman of Condé Nast, the great magazine publishing corporation, supposedly banned garlic from the Condé Nast cafeteria. And all of a sudden, Gawker was writing about him as if he was a vampire. Cy Newhouse was used to controlling the news cycle himself. So all of a sudden, these characters that had just never been touched, whether it was Cy Newhouse or some guy who sent his kid up in a balloon, were all of a sudden becoming gossip items.
Now, notwithstanding the broader definition of gossip-worthy, Ground Zero was still Hollywood TV or movie-famous celebrities. And even in that category of subject matter, the tabloids have been pushed aside by online competition like TMZ.
Harvey Levin was a producer on Court TV. He was doing a lot of true crime stories and all of a sudden decided to get in the celebrity market. He tried to do New York for a bit. It didn't work. So then he came to LA and just had cameras flying around like literal gadflies. So now TMZ is breaking actual news stories that are massive headlines. They were the first ones, for example, to confirm Michael Jackson's death. Nobody knew how they got that story. They just had incredible sources and were on the scene immediately. Richard Johnson, even Gawker, can't necessarily compete on that level.
So I must know, what is the sleaziest episode that you participated in or at least witnessed when you were an employee of Gawker?
I've never actually told this story before, but it was when David Carradine died from auto asphyxiation in Thailand.
The star of the TV series Kung Fu and later the Tarantino flick Kill Bill, Volumes 1 and 2.
There was a picture of Carradine's dead hanging body circulating in Thai newspapers. We found the picture on a website, and the order was called down for me to put the picture on the site. I got into a very, very long argument with my editor, and eventually it was agreed that we would only put the link on the site, which I still didn't like, because I believe if there's one group of people that should be at least given some modicum of respect in gossip pages, it should be people who were at least very recently dead. And I was told to screen grab or capture the picture and save it to my computer in case the link was pulled down and we had to put it on the site, which thankfully we never did.
And of course, even using the link generated the opprobrium of the public, who believed naturally that sometimes too much is just too much and probably didn't even click on the link.
Well, it was one of Gawker's 20 highest viewed posts in 2009 to the tune of about 400,000 page views.
That is so appalling. The society has so defined deviancy down, it's hard to know anymore what really constitutes a good juicy scandal. What's it take these days?
What's it take? Tiger Woods. When somebody previously thought to be morally infallible becomes morally fallible, that's a great scoop.
Feet of clay, the gift that keeps on giving.
Every time.
All right. Foster, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Foster Kamer is a staff writer for The Village Voice in New York City.
A press agent eats a columnist's dirt and is expected to call it manna.
But don't you help columnists by furnishing them with items?
Sure. A columnist can't do without us, except our good and great friend J.J. forgets to mention that. You see, we furnish him with items.
What, some cheap, gruesome gags?
You print them, don't you?
Yes, with your clients' names attached. That's the only reason the poor slobs pay you, to see their names in my column all over the world. Now I make it out you're doing me a favor?
I didn't say
that. The day I can't get along without a press agent's handouts, I'll close up shop and move to Alaska lock, stock, and barrel.
That's Tony Curtis as Sidney Falco, press agent and hatchet man to the ruthless columnist J.J. Hunsecker, played by Burt Lancaster, in The Sweet Smell of Success, Hollywood's dark depiction of the power once wielded by the likes of Walter Winchell in the 40s and beyond. But Walter Winchell had a philosophy that there were important lessons to be learned in the comings and goings of the rich and famous.
Back in 1925, a fellow by the name of Stephen Clow ran a newspaper he called Broadway Brevities. It had a relatively small circulation in the low thousands, but he operated on the principle that if you paid him or took out an advertisement, he would not write derogatory information about you. Now, that went on for several years until finally someone blew the whistle on him, someone who was tired of being extorted in this fashion, and Clow and three associates were actually brought to trial. And Clow was sentenced to 6 years in federal prison. He wasn't sentenced for blackmail because none of the people about whom he had talked wanted to go into court and have to fend off the charges. And that way they'd almost be giving credence to the charges. So instead of doing that, they tried him for conspiracy to defraud people through the mail.
Now, this was a pretty high-profile arrest and conviction, but you say that it didn't slow down the march of gossip at all.
Oh, no. If anything, it seemed to accelerate it. Let's face it, there's an enormous taste for gossip. Walter Winchell was really the first to institutionalize that in the gossip column back in the mid-1920s, roughly at the same time that Broadway Brevities was being published. Gossip happened to fit a national temper and a national mood. The 1920s were full of arguments over democracy and what democracy meant. And if you look at gossip, and if you really examine the subtext of gossip, gossip is about democratization. It's about egalitarianism. It's a form of empowerment for the outsiders. Walter Winchell identified himself very, very closely with his readers. He did not identify himself with the people about whom he gossiped. And in fact, the readers felt that Winchell was kind of their tribune. He was their scourge against the powerful.
And he's responsible for pushing gossip, which was once the province of specialty magazines, into the mainstream media.
Yes, he did, because he understood what gossip was about. Now, a lot of people don't realize that Walter Winchell gained an enormous amount of popularity in the 1930s by allying himself with Franklin Roosevelt and essentially becoming a political commentator. So that if you read Winchell's column, or if you listen to Winchell's radio broadcast, which was, by the way, the number one rated informational broadcast on radio, you would hear him gossip about somebody's divorce or romance or whatever with one item, and the very next item would be about Franklin Roosevelt or Adolf Hitler.
Alexandria. It will be denied, it always is, but the evidence is mounting that the Kremlin and the Muslim leaders are working out a grand alliance. If this is true, then it would mean that so far as Joe Stalin is concerned, so long, bye-bye, and ta-ta to a free Palestine. Bahrain, Arabia. Arabian oil production is expected to reach an all-time high. And in power politics, an oil field is what a water hole is in a jungle or a desert. Look for plenty of trouble then, east of Suez and west of Bombay, and tell Mr. Molotov that he can't stop Winchell from reporting in advance what some diplomats are trying to scoop me on, a third world war.
Now, Winchell thought of himself as a journalist, but readers didn't think of him as a journalist.
Did they not think of him as a journalist because he didn't actually practice journalism? I mean, did he employ the sorts of rules, the sourcing that we expect and trust in journalism?
There was some reporting. I mean, he did things that most gossip columnists today did not do. For example, he covered the war and got inside information from the Roosevelt administration about war planning. He was very close to J. Edgar Hoover, so he got a lot of items from the FBI, although truth be told, he gave more items to the FBI than he got from the FBI. But because there was this kind of transaction between Winchell and government, there was a certain degree of sourcing that even so-called reputable reporters didn't have access to.
Because he had changed the balance of power among the famous, he was more powerful than they were. He needed them, but they needed him even more.
What you've described was unquestionably true. But that balance of power has changed unquestionably over the last, I would say, 30 years or so. The media once held the power. You needed the media. Now the celebrity has the power. The world came to Walter Winchell. What we've learned about Richard Johnson and about Jared Stern, the two people who are involved on page six, is that they sought to cozy up to power, that they wanted to be among the wealthy, the elite. That changes the relationship of the gossip columnist to his subject, and frankly, it changes the relationship of the reader to the gossip column. And it's one of the reasons, among many others, that the gossip column doesn't have the same kind of clout. Because people reading the gossip column now are seeing the gossip columnist as a tribune from the powerful to them.
So what ultimately brought Winchell's career to an end? When he became less the FDR Democrat and more the McCarthyite acolyte?
Well, that happened. He did move from championing FDR to championing Joseph McCarthy, although he saw it as another seamless transition. Because as he saw it, he was against the elites. FDR was, and so was Joseph McCarthy. If there was any incident, it was when the singer Josephine Baker, black singer, felt she was being stiffed at the Store Club, which was Winchell's hangout. And Winchell ultimately came to the defense of the Store Club, not to the defense of Josephine Baker. And since Winchell had always been identified with minorities, with the disenfranchised, with the poor, this began a salient for opponents of Walter Winchell to attack him. And indeed, the New York Post ran a long series of articles attacking Walter Winchell, and that certainly hurt him.
We stopped liking him. We could stop forgiving him for entertaining us so well.
That's absolutely true.
All right, Neil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Gabler is a senior fellow at the University of Southern California and author of Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity.
Attention, Mr. and Mrs. United States. In the 19th century, Abraham Lincoln fought for the principle that no man had the right to live by another man's sweat. In the 20th century, Abraham Lincoln would have fought twice as hard for the right of a man to say what he thinks, whether that man is speaking in a corner drugstore or over a national radio hookup. If Abraham Lincoln were with us today, he would be denouncing power politics over a microphone and probably be leading the latest Crosley, Hooper, or Nielsen radio.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Brett Jaspers, and Alex Goldman, with more help from Nerida Brownlee and Bonnie Watt, and edited by Brooke. Our engineer this week was Robert Granis. We also say goodbye to Mark Phillips after 4 years at On the Media. We will miss his energy, his enthusiasm, his fantastic ideas, his labors, his music, especially his jingle writing, and his reporting. Mark, all the best.
Let's have a little excerpt of Mark.
Hey, kids, I'm Bill the Bill. Want to hear how I might become a law?
Yeah!
It's simple. Just follow along. Come on.
Someone writes me, I get a sponsor. Committee's where I go first. Once through committee, I go to the floor, and that's where they debate.
Sounds fun!
Totally.
Bye-bye, Mark. We'll miss you. K Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.